A science story, huh?
Is NYU scientist the...
I felt right.
It was that golden moment.
Because science was on my side.
Hey everyone, I'm Ben Lilly, and welcome to the Story Collider, where we bring you true stories of how science has affected people's lives. This week's story is from Abby Rabinowitz as part of Human Enhancement, a collaboration with the New York Hall of Science to produce stories related to the Human Plus exhibit on how technology is changing who we are. The story was recorded in April 2014 at iBeam in New York City.
Two years ago, I went on a quest to find a white baby who was rumored to be lost in Mumbai. I'd heard this rumor from a filmmaker in Brooklyn who, like me, was researching surrogate motherhood in India. And now, according to the story, there was an HIV-positive surrogate who was commanded by her doctor to have a late-term abortion. But the baby was born alive, or so the story went. And the foreign couple who'd hired this woman to bear their child would never know that the baby existed. Was the story true? I decided that I would find out. Now, at this point, I'd been researching surrogate motherhood in India for 3 years. I'd come across the story first as a graduate student, and then I went to Mumbai, where I spent 9 months interviewing surrogate mothers and egg donors. And these women are part of what is essentially a new form of medical tourism, where clients come from countries where surrogacy is illegal or expensive to hire local women in India to bear their children at bargain rates. And it's really made possible by a new line of fertility technologies, namely in vitro fertilization. And so these women never carry their own genetic child. They carry an embryo that's created with a donated egg. And so the thinking goes, these women won't have the kind of, I guess, deep emotional connection we expect mothers to have for their own children. And so we can pay them for this work like it's any other form of work. And so surrogate motherhood in India raises really interesting ethical questions, not least of which, I think, is this question of whether or not it's fair, for such wildly unequal parties to make a financial deal. And so when I was speaking with women in India, I concluded that while they were prepared, or I began to conclude, that while they were prepared to give up the babies they carried, they were often cheated financially and were put at a heightened medical risk. Still, though, they wanted to do this work because it represented at least maybe 3 to 5 years of their annual pay. And so when I got back to New York the first time, I did my best to sell this story, or maybe almost my best to tell the story. I mean, I'm a writer, so we tend to procrastinate, right? I pitched it. And magazines didn't seem that interested, and I think that's essentially because the headline was, "Poor women pretty much exploited in India," which I guess isn't really news. I know. And so when I heard the story of the white baby who might or might not have been lost in Mumbai, I thought, aha, I could use the narrative of trying to find this white baby to get people interested in the women who I was really wanting to write about. And so 2 years ago, I got on a plane in the dead of winter in Newark, New Jersey, and I flew 15 hours to Mumbai. And on the plane, I just daydreamed about this white baby. I pictured this baby pale and chubby, sitting on the lap of a woman in a sari, his forehead smudged with lucky coal, cared for, but profoundly misplaced. And I decided that I would find this baby, and I would also sell a best-selling work of long-form nonfiction journalism, which has really been the life goal for, approximately 10 years. Now this might sound far-fetched to you. It sounds a bit far-fetched to me thinking about it, but it didn't seem that far-fetched because the filmmaker had heard the story from a friend of a woman named Kamala, who happened to be my main contact in the surrogacy community. She was a former surrogate mother who made her living recruiting new surrogate mothers and egg donors. And so I thought to myself, I would simply go to Kamala, I would get the phone number of this friend, and I would find out what happened. It would be straightforward. but I don't know if you've ever been to India. If you have, you know that nothing there really happens in a terribly straightforward fashion. I mean, from the minute you step off the plane into the hot, smoky, humid night, everything is chaos. Like, you have trucks, cars, rickshaws, bullock carts, vendors, and everywhere the honking of horns. The day after I arrived in Mumbai, profoundly jet-lagged, I met my translator in the equivalent of Mumbai's Grand Central Station, only infinitely made more chaotic. And we got on a train to go see Kamala. She lives in a city called Ulasnagar, which is 30 miles from Mumbai. When you know you're getting to Ulasnagar because you smell something really terrible. The train pulls up alongside this broad, shallow, sewage-smelling river where black hogs root, full of industrial effluents. It's Ulasnagar is known for producing cheap replicas of American blue jeans, among other things. My translator and I got in a rickshaw. We got to Kamala's house. The family was really excited to see us. It had been 2 years since we'd been back. I gave presents, made small talk, and the whole time I was thinking, what's happening with that white baby? What's happening? And so finally, I was sitting with my translator on the bed, because that's where you sit in a small Indian home. It's your place of honor as a guest. And I finally get to ask Kamala, what has happened? And so I'm waiting in great suspense as she's speaking in Marathi, kind of scowling. And finally, my translator turns to me and she says, Kamala says that the woman who had this baby is named Priya, and she sold the baby. She sold it for adoption. And I was incredibly disappointed for a couple of reasons. First, I thought, it's going to be so much harder to find this baby. I mean, assuming this baby exists, we're still working from hearsay. But I was actually really pretty disappointed in myself because I've been researching surrogacy for 3 years, and I knew that these women did not have babies for sentimental reasons. They had babies to make money, and so if Priya was not paid for the work of carrying this baby, she would have to sell the baby herself. How to find Priya. Kamala did have the phone number of Padma, who's the agent who recruited Priya, and we got to meet with her a few days later. We sat with her in her small, dim home. I got to drink a scalding cup of very sweet chai, and Padma told me the story of the pregnancy. When Priya was 7 months pregnant, she was ordered to get a sonogram, and the doctor who had hired her, whose name is Dr. Vasudha, she's like a homeopathic doctor who kind of recruits surrogate mothers and regulates their care. In any case, she looked at the sonogram and she saw an irregularity in the brain, or so Padma, the agent, told me. And so she ordered Priya to go to an obstetrician to have the fetus aborted. Apparently, at the same time, according to Padma, the obstetrician did a scan and found that the surrogate mother, Priya, had HIV. And she also refused to perform the abortion, presumably because the pregnancy was already so far advanced. And apparently several other hospitals did as well, until finally one hospital did take Priya. Dr. Vasudha called the medical tourist agent, and this is the guy who represents the foreign couple who's hired Priya to bear their child. And Dr. Vasudha told them that there had been a miscarriage. And apparently, and again, you have to remember, this is all possibly rumor, but it was incredibly detailed, this story. And so Padma said that the medical tourist agent and the couple even showed up at the clinic demanding to see the body of this fetus. But there was no body to see because at 8 months and 2 days, Priya gave birth to what appeared to be a healthy baby boy to Padma, a foreign baby boy. And when Dr. Vasudha found out, she said, you have to bring this baby to an orphanage. I mean, she's already told the couple that the baby is dead. And presumably the baby might have brain damage or HIV, who knows. But Priya refused. She'd been paid less than half of what she'd been promised. And instead she sold the baby to a couple in Ulasnagar. I asked Padma, where is the baby now? Where is this family? And she didn't know. And I said, well, does the baby have HIV? And she didn't know. But she said, I do have a picture of the baby on my phone. And so she handed me her phone, and I look at the cell phone, and I see this picture of a baby who's nothing like what I imagined. dark-eyed, shriveled, wearing this strange little pink poke bonnet, this little creature. And the baby did not look white. So I said to Padma, I think this is an Indian baby. And she said, no, that baby is white. And I said, okay. And my translator's like, well, maybe it's Priya's own child. Maybe she carried her own baby. There was really only one person who could tell us, maybe, and that was Priya. So Padma called Priya on her phone. Everyone always has their phone in India. It's one of the great things about doing research there, another way in which technology has made this business possible. And so Priya picks up. She's reluctant to meet with us, but finally she says, okay, I'll talk to you, but you have to come to me. I'm at my sister's bedside in this hospital in Mumbai. So we get on a train. We get in a taxi. We're rushing to get to this hospital. It's a big municipal hospital. There are stray dogs, literally roam the courtyards. People are lying on pallets on the floor. Windows are broken. It was so surreal being there, and I was really hot and tired. And because of all the chai, I had to pee for approximately 4 hours. We're looking for a place, ward 6, room 3. And of course, we found that the ward we were looking for didn't even exist. And at that point, I found myself feeling, I guess frustrated, but also sort of relieved, because I think this feeling had been growing in me that I would absolutely have no idea what to do if I did find proof that there had been a baby and that he had been sold. It's one of these things where you begin to learn about yourself and realize that as a nonfiction reporter, maybe you actually just want to report the biographies of dead presidents, so you have no responsibility whatsoever. At this point, I'd been in India, I know it sounds short, but it had taken a while. I only had about a week left. I spoke to the obstetrician and also Dr. Vasuda. They both denied treating an HIV-positive surrogate. I also, when I got back to the States, I would call the medical tourist agent. He would say that he'd heard a rumor of a story like this, but he would deny any personal involvement. So, still in Mumbai, tried Priya on her phone a few times, and she wasn't picking up. And I began to feel really guilty for harassing her, because if the story was true, she'd sold a baby, which is as illegal in India as it is in America. But if she was like the other women I'd interviewed, she wouldn't have had that much of a choice. On this trip, I never really got over my jet lag. India's always 9.5 or 10 hours ahead of us. And I just lay awake at nights kind of electric with anxiety. And a part of that is innate to my personality, but this was a more extreme level of electric with anxiety, because I kept on picturing what I would, like as I said, what I'd do if I found this baby. In India, surrogacy is legal, but the legal regulations are totally unclear. And there have been several cases where babies are born in between nationalities, stuck in a legal limbo. And so if this baby did exist, and again, we're still in the land of rumor, he was technically Priya's baby, because he would have been born in a hospital that would have issued a birth certificate in her name. Alternately, he belonged to the Ulasnagar couple who adopted or bought him. Alternately, he belonged to the foreign clients who commissioned him, or else he was just globalization's child. He was nobody's responsibility in particular, and he was least of all mine. But I still felt guilty. The night before I flew back to Newark, I had a fever and the chills. The next morning, I got on the plane anyway. They were showing Contagion, and I just shut my eyes because I knew that I was patient zero. I got off the plane, and luckily my father was there, and the next day he and my mother took me to the doctor and then the hospital, where I was admitted with what turned out to be dengue fever, which, if you don't know it, it's a nasty mosquito-borne virus in which patients experience something called the dengue triad that I hope you do not experience. It is comprised of a piercing headache, high fever, and this hot pink rash that feels like the worst sunburn you've ever had, except for these white spots on your body that are called Isles of Sparing, I guess because they're spared turning bright pink. There's also a neurological component, and I experienced it as total dread. It was just awful. And so after 3 days in the hospital, I was released home to my parents' care. I was lying on the couch, and I was finally telling my mother about the research I was doing, which the more I talked about it, and even talking about it now, sounded more and more like a hallucination of some kind. And I was saying, there's a baby out there. He could be sick. I think he exists. And then my mother, I realized, was listening to me with the patient disbelief that's generally reserved for the mentally unsound, because she didn't care if this baby existed. She was just pretty happy that I was alive. And that's when I really began to see, I think for the first time, that my quest to find the white baby was grandiose and misplaced, and also probably a little bit irrational, because there are millions of babies out there who are lost, who need help, who are Indian or American, who have HIV or who don't. But even more than that, that search ran counter to my original, if less marketable, project of trying to tell these women's stories. Because even if I'd found that baby, I still wouldn't be any closer to really telling their stories, which are harder to tell for me, because they're less concrete. There's not a nice narrative arc. There's not suspense in the same way. These are stories about inequity and unfairness. They're about limited choice. They're about the really foreign territory of another person's heart. This past winter, I went back to Mumbai again, and this time I really did my best to listen. I talked to women who never really understood or read the contents of the contract that signed over the rights to their uteruses and to the babies they would carry. I did talk to a woman who had pulled herself into the middle class by being an agent for these new surrogate mothers and egg donors. I talked to a woman who was forced to have an abortion at some point in her pregnancy and was made to carry the contents in a glass jar back to Dr. Vasuda. And I talked to a woman who begged me to find the foreign parents of the baby she carried because she still needed more money. And that's kind of an enduring theme. For the surrogate mothers of India, the money really never goes as far as they dream. And I'm still looking for a way to tell these women's stories.
That was Abby Rabinowitz. Abby teaches writing at Columbia University, where she earned her MFA in nonfiction writing. Her work has appeared in the journal Science, The New York Times, and Nautilus. For more science stories, take a look at storycollider.org, where we have archives of the podcast and upcoming events. Also, we depend on listeners like you for our support. If you love the podcast, please consider donating at storycollider.org/donate. The Human Plus exhibit and much more are on display at the New York Hall of Science in Queens, New York. NYSCI.org for more information. The Story Collider is produced by me, Brian Wecht, Aaron Barker, and Ari Daniel. The podcast is produced by Rose Eveleth. Additional help from Brooke Williams, Lena Groger, and Justin D'Ambrosio. The theme music is by Ghost. Special thanks to iBeam for hosting the show, to the New York Hall of Science for being wonderful partners, and to birds for flying around my window and scaring the cat. Thanks for listening.